The growth of vegetation at the crest of the hills was dense and spiny. I was glad of the machete I'd had with me, and I hacked a pass for us through it. We'd marked the approximate position of the hole from the plain below, but even then we blundered about in the undergrowth for 2 hours, before I very nearly walked into it. Suddenly the earth opened at my feet in that frightening black shaft, and I threw myself backwards, nearly knocking Sally down. Whew, that was a near one. I was shaken, and I kept a respectful distance from the edge as we worked our way round to where a slab of stone jutted squarely out into the void. I knelt on the lip to examine the stone. Far below, the surface of the emerald pool glowed in the gloomy depths. I do not like exposed heights, and I felt distinctly queasy as I leaned out to touch the flat surface of the stone. "It's certainly regular, Sal." I ran my hands over it. "But I can't feel any chisel marks. It's been badly weathered, though. Perhaps..." I looked up and froze with horror. Sally had walked out onto the stone platform, as though it were a diving board. She stood now with her toes over the edge, and as I watched in horror, she lifted her hands above her head. She pointed them straight at the sky, with all her fingers and both thumbs extended stiffly in that same gesture she had used when she first saw the emerald pool. "Sally!" I screamed, and her head jerked. She swayed slightly, and I scrambled to my knees. "Don't! Don't, Sally, don't!" I screamed again, for I knew she was about to plunge into the hungry stone mouth. Slowly she leaned out over the gap. I ran out onto the stone platform, and as she went forward beyond the point of balance, my hand closed on her upper arm. For brief, unholy seconds, we teetered and struggled together on the lip of stone, and then I dragged her back and pulled her to safety. Suddenly she was shaking and weeping hysterically, and I clung to her, for I also was badly scared. Something had happened that was beyond my understanding, something mystical and deeply disturbing. When Sally's sobs had abated, I asked her gently, "What happened, Sal? Why did you do it?"
I don't know. I just felt dizzy, and there was a black roaring in my head, and... Oh, I don't know. Ben, I just don't know.
It was another 20 minutes before Sally seemed sufficiently recovered to begin the journey back to camp, and by then the sun was setting. Before we reached the path down the cliff face, it was completely dark. "The moon will be up in a few minutes, Sal. I don't fancy going down the cliff in the dark. Let's wait for it." We sat on the edge of the cliff, huddled together, not for warmth, for the air was still hot and the rocks were sunbaked, but because both of us were still a little shaken from the experience we'd just come through. The moon was a big silver glow beneath the horizon. Then it pushed up, fat and yellow and round, above the trees, and washed the land with a soft, pale light. I looked at Sally. Her face was silver-grey in the moonlight, with dark, bruised eyes, and her expression was remote and infinitely sad. "Shall we go, Sal?" And I hugged her lightly.
"In a minute. It's so beautiful."
I turned to stare out over the moon-silver plain. Africa has many moods and many faces, and I love them all. Here before us, she put on one of her more enchanting displays. We were silent and engrossed for a long time. Suddenly I felt Sally stir against me, half rising. "Ready?" I asked her, rising with her.
"Ben."
Her hand closed on my wrist with surprising strength. She was shaking my arm.
"Ben! Ben!"
"What is it, Sal?" I was seized with dread that her earlier mood had returned.
"Look, look, Ben. Look!"
Her voice was choked with emotion. "What is it, Sal? Are you all right?" With one hand she was shaking my arm. With the other she was pointing down at the plane below us. "Look, Ben. Look, there it is." "Sally." I put both arms around her to restrain her. "Easy, my dear, easy. Just sit down quietly." "Don't be a fool, Ben. I'm perfectly all right. Just look down there." Still holding her securely, I did as she asked. I stared and saw nothing. "Do you see it, Ben?" "No." And then, like the face in the picture puzzle, it was there. It was there as it should have been from the beginning. "Can you see it?" Sally was trembling. "Tell me you can see it too, Ben. Tell me I'm not imagining it." Yes, I mumbled, still not certain. "Yes, I think it's the city of the moon, Ben. The ghost city of the Bushmen. It's our lost city, Ben. It is. It is. It must be." It was vague, hazy. I shut my eyes tightly and opened them again. It was still there. The double enclosure around the silent grove. Vast symmetrical tracings on the silver plain. Dark, shadowy lines. There were the dark circles that marked the spots on which the phallic towers had stood, some of them obscured by the trees of the grove. Beyond the walls were the honeycomb cells of the lower city, crescent-shaped and spread around the shores of the ancient vanished lake. "The moon," I whispered, "low angle, picking up the outline of the foundations. They must be so flattened that we've walked over them. Lived on top of them for a month. The light of the full moon is just the right strength to cast shadows where the remains stand slightly proud." "The photograph?" "Yes, from 36,000 feet. The light low enough and soft enough to give the same effect," I agreed. "We probably wouldn't have seen it from such a low altitude, and the helicopter didn't go high enough," Sally suggested. "And it was noon," I agreed. "High-angle sun, no shadows. That's why Lurin didn't see it from the helicopter." It was so simple, and I'd missed it. Some bloody genius. They must have botched the tests. "But there are no walls, Ben. No towers, nothing. Only the foundations. What happened to it? What happened to our city?" "We'll find out, Sal," I promised. "But now let's mark it before it disappears again." I handed her the one torch from the knapsack. One flash means come towards me. Two flashes move away from me. Three move left. Four move right. And a windmill means you're on it. Quickly we agreed a simple code. "I'll go down onto the plane and you signal me. Put me on top of the large tower first, then guide me around the perimeter of the outer walls. We'd better work fast. We don't know how long the effect will last. Give me a flat cut-out sign when it goes." It lasted a little over an hour, with me scampering about on the plain in obedience to Sally's signals. And then the city faded, and slowly vanished as the moon rose towards its zenith. I went up to fetch Sally down from the cliff. I was bare to the waist, having ripped my shirt to shreds and tied strips of it onto clumps of grass and shrubs as markers. Back in camp, we built a huge fire, and I got out the Glen Grant to celebrate. We were so elated, and there was so much to discuss and marvel over, that sleep was long delayed. We went over the lighting phenomenon again in greater detail, agreeing how it worked and ruefully remembering how close we'd come to the truth when we discussed the low sun effect on our very first day, the day we discovered the freshwater mussel shells. We discussed the shells and their new significance. I swear here and now, with all the gods as my witness, that I will never again toss a piece of vital scientific evidence over my shoulder. I made oath and testament. Let's drink to that, suggested Sal. What a wonderful idea, I agreed, and refilled the glasses. Then we went on to the old Bushman story. It just goes to show you that every piece of legend, every piece of folklore is based on some fact, however garbled. Sally becomes all philosophical after one shot of Glen Grant. And let's face facts. My blood brother Chai is a champion garbler of facts from way back. The City of the Moon, forsooth. It's a lovely name. Let's keep it, Sally suggested. And what do you think about Chai's grandfather actually meeting one of the white ghosts? He probably saw one of the old hunters or prospectors, remember? We nearly had ghost status awarded us. Literally and figuratively, Sally reminded me. The talk went on and on, while the moon made its splendid transit of the sky above us. Every now and then, serious discussion degenerated into effusive outbursts of, "Oh, Ben, isn't it wonderful? We've got a whole Phoenician city to excavate, all to ourselves," or, "My God, Sal, all my life I've dreamt of something like this happening to me." It was long past midnight before we got our feet back on the earth, and Sally brought up the subject of practical procedure. "What do we do, Ben? Do we tell Lurin Stuyvesant now?" I poured another drink slowly while I considered this. "Don't you think, Sal, don't you think we should sink a pothole, a small one, of course, on the foundations, just to be certain we're not making fools of ourselves?" "Ben, you know that's the first rule. Don't go scratching around haphazardly. You might destroy something valuable. We should wait until we can go in on an orderly, organized basis." "I know, Sal, but I can't just help myself. Just one tiny little hole?" "All right," she grinned. "Just one tiny little hole." "I suppose we better try and get some sleep now. It's past 2 o'clock. Just before we finally drifted off, Sally murmured against my chest, "I still wonder what happened to our city. If the Bushman picture was correct, then huge walls and towers of masonry have vanished into thin air." "Yes, yes, it's going to be exciting finding out." With that strength of character which I am able occasionally to conjure up, I firmly thrust aside the temptation to open a trench within the temple enclosure, and instead I chose a spot upon the foundations of the outer wall, where I hoped I would do minimum damage. With Sally watching avidly and volunteering more than her share of advice, I marked out with tapes torn from my sheets the outline of the intended excavation. A narrow trench, 3 foot wide and 20 foot long, set at a right angle to the run of the foundations, so as to open a cross-section of the horizon. We numbered the tapes at intervals of 1 foot, and Sally cross-referenced her notebook to the markings on the tapes. I fetched the cameras, tools, and tarpaulin from the Land Rover. Our trench was only 30 yards from the tents. We had camped almost on top of the ancient wall. I spread the tarpaulin, ready to receive the earth removed from the trench, and then I pulled off my shirt and threw it aside. I was no longer ashamed to expose my body in front of Sally. I spat on the palms of my hands, straddled the tapes, hefted the pick, and glanced at Sally, sitting attentively on the tarpaulin, with a big floppy-brimmed hat on her head. "Okay," I grinned at her. "All the way, partner," she said. And I was startled. The words jarred. They were Lurin's and mine. We didn't say them to other people. And then suddenly I thought, "Ah, what the hell? I love her also." "All the way, girl," I agreed, and swung the pick. It was good to feel the pick, feather light in my hands, and the head clunking deep into the sandy earth. I worked steadily, swinging pick and shovel easily. But soon the sweat was running in rivulets down my body and soaking my breeches. As I shoveled the earth from the trench and piled it on the tarpaulin, Sally began sifting it carefully. She chattered away happily as she worked, but my only reply was the grunt at each swing of the pick. By noon, I'd opened a trench along its full length to a depth of 3 feet. The sandy soil gave way at a depth of 18 inches to a dark reddish loam, which still held the damp of the recent rains. We rested, and I ate a mess of canned food and drank a bottle of Windhoek to replace some of my lost moisture. "You know," Sally looked me over thoughtfully, "once you get used to it, your body has a strange sort of beauty," she said, and I blushed until my eyes watered. I worked for another hour, and then suddenly the bite of the pick turned up black. I swung again, still black. I dropped the pick and knelt in the trench. "What is it?" Sally was there immediately. "Ash," I said. "Charcoal." "An ancient hearth," she guessed. "Perhaps." I didn't commit myself, luckily, so that later I could chide her for her presumption. "Let's take some samples for dating." I worked more carefully now, trying to expose the layer of ash without disturbing it. We sampled it and found that it varied between 1/4 inch and 2 inches deep across the full horizon of the trench. Sally noted the depth from surface and the position of each of the carbon samples we took, while I photographed the trench and tapes. Then we straightened up and looked at each other. "Too big for a hearth," she said, and I nodded. "We shouldn't go deeper, Ben. Not like this. Crashing in with pick and shovel." "I know," I said. "We will stop on half the trench. Leave the layer of ash undisturbed. I'll make that concession to the rules. But I am as sure as hell going down on the rest of it to bedrock, if I can." "I'm glad you said that." Sally applauded my decision. "It's exactly what I feel as well." "Well, you begin at the far end. I'll start here, and we'll work towards each other," I instructed. And we began lifting the layer of ash from half the trench. I found that immediately below it was a floor of hard clay, and though I didn't say so, I guessed it was a building filler, a transported layer not occurring naturally. "Go carefully," I cautioned Sally. "Quoth the pick and shovel man," she muttered sarcastically without looking up. And almost immediately she made the first discovery from the ruins of the City of the Moon. As I write, I have a notebook in front of me, with her grubby, earthy fingerprints upon the pages, and her big, schoolgirlish handwriting filling it. Trench 1, reference AC-6-2-4, depth 4 feet 2.5 inches. Item, 1 glass bead, oval, blue, circumference 2.5 millimeters, pierced, slightly heat-distorted. Remarks, found in layer of ash at level 1. Index number CM1. This laconic notation can give no idea of our jubilation, the way we hugged each other and laughed in the sun. It was a typical blue Phoenician trade bead, and I cupped the tiny pellet of glass in my one hand. "I'm going to take it and stick it up their backsides," I threatened, referring, of course, to my critics. "If that end is as narrow as their minds, Ben, dear, then it'll be a pretty tight fit." I started using a small pick, and 15 minutes later, I made the next discovery, a charred fragment of bone. "Human?" Sally asked. "Possibly," I said. "Head of a human femur. The shaft has been burnt away." "Cannibalism? Cremation?" Sally hazarded. "You do run on," I said. "Well, what do you think, then?" she challenged. I was silent for a long time, and then I made up my mind and came out with it. I think at this level, the city of the moon was sacked and burnt, its inhabitants were slaughtered, the walls thrown down, and its buildings obliterated. Sally whistled softly, staring at me in mock amazement. On the evidence of one bead and a piece of bone, that just has to be the greatest flyer of all time.